Hello, and welcome to the seventh episode of the podcast series AGG Talks, Antitrust and White Collar Roundup, in which we cover the legal facts surrounding recent cases, trends, and hot topics related to white collar crime and antitrust with some of the most foremost legal analysts in the country. My name is Jeff Jacobowitz. I am a trial attorney with Arnell Golden Gregory. I'm also an adjunct criminal antitrust law professor at the Washington College of Law, and I chair the firm's antitrust group. I have appeared a number of times on CNN and MSNBC regarding white-collar criminal issues related to the Mueller investigation and the Donald Trump-related indictments and investigations. I'm joined today by Elliot Williams, a CNN legal analyst and former DOJ Deputy Assistant Attorney General. He is now affiliated with the Rabin Group, public affairs firm in Washington, D.C., and he's here with me today to go over the ongoing litigation against former President Trump. Elliot and I will explore E. G. Carroll's defamation lawsuit, issues that have arisen in the Georgia RICO case, and the pending appeal in the January 6th Jack Smith case, as well as the Colorado decision, which is currently before the Supreme Court. So, Elliot, E. G. Carroll went to trial before a jury on damages related to her defamation lawsuit against Trump. Did you find anything unique about this case?
I really didn't find anything unique about the case, which is sort of sad here, partly because we are so used to this world of legal circus surrounding the former president. And I don't say that to disparage him or anyone around him, but the simple fact is he's been charged with a number of crimes and seems to be followed by civil suits wherever he goes. So the notion that this particular defendant has both serious defamation claims brought against him, and in fact, quite ugly sexual assault allegations, some of which were blessed by a jury, isn't surprising at this point. And that's sort of a sad state of American public legal affairs right now, I think.
And in fact, it has been blessed by a jury, and this trial is only related to damages.
Of course.
What do you think about the former president's persistent statements about E. Jean Carroll during the case, prior to the case, et cetera?
You know, absolutely. And you, having represented clients, know one of the first rules you tell your client is don't speak publicly either about your matter or anything else. Because let's set aside the substance of the specific comments that the former president has made about E. Jean Carroll. Every single thing he says not just can be used against him in a future proceeding, but could be used in this proceeding, either to impeach evidence that's already in the record, could be used in a contempt proceeding tied to this matter, and so on. Now, certainly he's a candidate for office and one of the most famous people literally on the planet right now. And so there are challenges in muzzling any defendant, let alone one who's running for office or has a big national platform. But he's really running the risk of putting himself in legal peril far more than any sort of embarrassment to himself or his attorneys.
And, you know, I've told clients, please don't speak to the media, but you have to have control over your client. And he's probably doing it for political reasons, not legal reasons. But how high do you think punitive damages could go here?
It's hard to say. What we know, that the point of punitive damages is not just to take something away from the defendant and provide some sort of recompense to the plaintiff, but to actually harm the defendant in some way, such that they don't commit the same act again in the future or other people are deterred from doing so. I guess the question is, when an individual is in fact a billionaire, what measure of punitive damages will actually hurt? And a lot of these matters involving the former president, you know, what is the harm you're going to end up providing to this individual? And in practical terms, if you put a $4 or $5 million punitive settlement, which would devastate virtually every American, you know, is it really going to matter? So it's hard to say exactly what the full amount will be here, other than it's probably more a statement to the public than this individual defendant.
Well, we saw what happened to Rudy Giuliani in his defamation case. And I guess we have a federal judge here, Judge Kaplan, who's holding a tight ship. How do you think Kaplan is handling this case?
Oh, quite well. I have not appeared in front of Judge Kaplan. I don't know if you have. I know people who have. And he apparently runs a pretty tight ship in his courtroom. And people who are in and around courts quite a bit do recognize that there, let's say how many federal judges, there are around 900, 950 around the country, but they're 950 sui generis little fiefdoms. They're all run differently. They are staffed differently. The judges behave differently. And he runs a very ordered courtroom. It's an interesting contrast to some of these state proceedings we've seen involving the former president, where number one, there's cameras there, which you don't get in federal court at all. But number two, there's a looser, more freewheeling sense to the courtroom. People are more informal with the judge. People speak up more. And you get the sense from the little you read about what's going on in Kaplan's courtroom that number one, it is very tightly controlled. And number two, far more like federal court than some of these smaller state court proceedings we've seen.
Well, it's interesting. And we'll see what he does, because one of Trump's attorneys, Arlena Haba, told Judge Kaplan she actually either was not feeling well or she was exposed to COVID. Her parents were sick. And then she showed up at Trump's victory party in New Hampshire in the primary. So it'll be interesting to see how Judge Kaplan handles that.
It will. And remember, the judge has full latitude to set the scheduling of the proceeding, to pause or delay the proceedings, so long as his doing so doesn't get in the way of the defendant's right to fair, speedy, and open trial. So perhaps the judge could issue a pause or something. You know, this, it all brings us back to 2020 and 2021 in some way, where we are all in this country in various places as to our acceptance of risk and tolerance of things like COVID, or COVID in particular. And here you saw an individual who was exposed to, I don't believe tested positive for, I could be wrong on that, but was exposed to, but still then knowingly attended public events. And again, it's almost root memory getting back to the height of the pandemic. And here we are again.
And what do you think about these outside comments? Like Congresswoman Stefanik made a comment about how this is all media generated. Do you think Judge Kaplan will take that into account? Or, you know, whether is it tampering with a jury? Well, what do you think that Carroll's attorney will argue?
Maybe. You can certainly make an argument that the jury's being tampered with. Now, of course, judges can at any point just say to the jury, set aside what you just heard. And if the jury all nods and said, yes, I can set aside what I just heard, there's no error or harm. It's almost, I always was bothered by this. It's so loosey-goosey that you can, as long as the juror, the prospective juror says they're fine legally. And so no matter, you know, I don't really think the statements themselves have a really profound impact. I think the bigger issue, and the particular Stefanik comment that I saw that I raised an eyebrow at a little bit, was there was a delay, I believe, over the not just the COVID incident, but a juror getting sick, and the judge postponed the trial about 48 or 72 hours. And Congresswoman Stefanik tweeted, this is election interference, which that's sad more than anything else. People around the country will believe things like that, will believe that the judge literally is putting his thumb on the scale and interfering with the election, when in fact, if you just read the next line of the article, that somebody got sick and the judge could either replace the juror outright or start over or pause the trial. And the judge in his discretion chose to just give 48 hours, let everybody take a beat and then reconvene. The tragedy is that a congresswoman like Congresswoman Stefanik, I'm not in her head. I don't know her personally, but I think it's safe to say she probably knew what she was doing there. And that in a political world that sort of is the Venn diagram intersection with a legal world, it's politics, it works in politics, but it's sort of bad for the integrity of the rule of law.
And the judge could have replaced the juror, because there are 9 jurors right now, and they could have gone down to 8, but he didn't do that. And he gave the juror every opportunity to continue on the case.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears for a second to recent development in the Georgia RICO case against Trump and a number of other defendants, which is very interesting. It involves an alleged relationship between Forney Willis, the chief prosecutor, and a lead prosecutor in the case, Nathan Wade. Can this impact on the prosecution of the defendants?
It absolutely can have an impact on the prosecution of the defendants. Now, let's be clear. This may well be a perfectly permissible relationship, either under Georgia law, under the official rules of the prosecutor's office, under ethical rules in the jurisdiction, whatever it may be. It may be fine. And frankly, sitting here, I don't know the answer to that. I'm not an expert in Georgia sexual harassment law in any of my current roles. Now, that said, a prosecutor or a public servant is only as good as the faith that the public has in the work they're doing. And these sort of personal peccadilloes, even if they are legitimate and morally proper or whatever else, get in the way of how the public sees the prosecution. And when you already have, whether it's 25 or 33% of the public already believing that these prosecutions are politically tainted and so on, you have a huge subset of the public who's just waiting for this prosecutor to screw up. Now, again, I'm not weighing in on the morality of it. The simple fact is, ethical questions in the law are as much about how seriously the proceeding looks to the public as they are, or pardon me, the impreparence of propriety, as the legal term is, as they are about what's actually wrong. And so they certainly could have an impact. Now, the question is, how do they cure it? And the solutions might be, number one, remove the special prosecutor, Mr. Wade. Number two, remove the head of the office. Number three, recuse the whole office altogether. Number four, bring in somebody from Cobb County or a nearby county in Georgia. I don't know, and it's really for the courts to sort out. But it's more than anything else, even if it's okay, it's caused a headache for the office, and you just can't have those when you're conducting a big prosecution.
Sure. And, you know, in fact, if Wade withdraws or if Tony Willis withdraws, and there's a change of on the top with prosecutors, there's a change of venue or a change of place of the prosecution, it could impact on the jury pool. So this could have a significant impact on the case. And if, in fact, there are appeals filed to what happens, it could delay the case, certainly until after the election. And that is something that it appears the former president wants. So this could have a big impact. And I know the family judge has released the divorce file. And in the media, people are saying, well, they took some trips together. And it's not clear who paid for the trips, whether in fact they took these trips. But if they did, that's certainly another factor.
It is. Now, this question, cutting the other way, I do think this question, and many have gone as far as to say, this was actually an improper kickback to the law firm, or pardon me, to the office, because she was paying him, and then therefore he was spending on her, which necessarily is an exchange of favors or whatever. I think that's sort of nonsense. That's going to require a level of carving up this law firm's assets and spending and looking into, well, whether each dollar the prosecutor's office paid this law firm was then in turn spent on the product. That's silly. People commingle some of their personal funds or use their salaries for different reasons. And I think that gets us into a little bit of crazy town. And I just think the bigger issue is just how it looks, even if it's okay. And, you know, we have to draw that distinction here. It may be legally proper, whatever the behavior is. You know, like the television show The Wire, you come at the king, you best not miss. Well, when you're investigating a former president or any prominent defendant, your work is going to receive a tremendous amount of scrutiny. And that's also going to include your personal behavior as the standard bearer for the office.
I think it's a stretch to say that this is a kickback, but it doesn't mean the defense won't allege it.
Oh, of course.
And if it leads to further delay, they're accomplishing one of their main goals.
Yeah. And moreover, it's in their interest to raise such things now because they waive the right to do so on appeal if they don't.
That's correct.
That you have to raise the argument as soon as you're aware of it. Otherwise, you can't raise it later on if he does get convicted.
Well, Elliot, let's move on to another issue. There's a significant appeal pending before the D.C. Circuit now related to the January 6th Jack Smith case. And when I say Jack Smith case, it's, again, the former president as the defendant. Absolute immunity for a president is before the D.C. Circuit. Are you familiar with the arguments that the parties have made here?
Oh, very well. It's a fascinating one. And the former president really just got eviscerated part of his team on this question of the limits. And, you know, you remember this from law school, professors would test the limits of an argument and say, okay, are you saying that a president could call in a drone strike using all of the powers of the president, call in a drone strike against a political opponent? It's just nonsense. And so that argument's not going to hold up. Certainly didn't hold up with the en banc petition, and it's not going to hold up with the Supreme Court.
Well, it's interesting because the D.C. Circuit still hasn't ruled, and we're expecting an expedited decision from them. If, in fact, they rule against the former president, which everybody is anticipating, What do you think the Supreme Court would do? Would they grant cert in this case?
They don't have to. And yeah, one of the greatest misconceptions about the United States Supreme Court is that they're obligated to take every case on. And they very well might not. You've got quite well-reasoned, unanimous appeals court decisions below. No substantial dispute among the circuits or anything like that as to the question. It's important because it involves the presidency. But there's really, I don't think, a lot of factual gray area or wiggle room on this one. The simple fact is no one, and the progeny of cases coming out of the Nixon administration in the 1970s make clear that the presidency entitles its holder to a certain measure of immunity for his or her official actions, but activity beyond that simply is not protected. And that's enshrined in American law. You know, we can bang our heads against the wall because it's a former president with a very loud platform. But the simple fact is the law is relatively clear on this issue.
And if, in fact, they don't grant cert, the case is likely to go to trial before the election. Isn't that correct?
I think because it right now is scheduled for March. Now, I believe that certainly I think we can sit here in late January and be quite confident that won't happen. Now, if it doesn't get picked up by the Supreme Court in a few weeks, they could set a trial in May or something, April, May, even June, and get the case wrapped up. So it certainly could.
Is the Supreme Court obligated to consider upcoming elections?
I don't think they are. And I would go even further and say, I don't think they should. Now, elections are core to who we are as a country, but it's not really the job of the courts or the prosecution system to consider other branches of government's needs in deciding what the correct path forward for the rule of law is. Now, for whatever reason, prosecutors did not bring these cases until late 2023. Now, whether that was a failure on their part, or as I know from having been a prosecutor, sometimes it just takes years to put investigations together, particularly of serious high-profile defendants with complex facts and so on. I don't know, but we are now, you got an election coming up, but that's not John Roberts' problem, I think. And you want to get the case right. You want to give every party the right to bring their appeals and be heard. But that doesn't mean that just because you have this thing coming up. Now, the one brief counterargument to my own argument is, well, this is fundamentally a case about elections and for the future of American elections, not just this particular candidate. It might make sense to move this one along. But again, that's not a requirement.
And that's also related to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which excludes from future office any person that rebels through overt insurrection. And that's an issue before the court right now also, because Colorado banned Trump from the primary ballot. Have the January 6th judges found that Trump engaged in insurrection?
It's hard to say. They have found that he was involved with January 6th. Now, the question is, how do you decide what it means to be involved in insurrection? And that's an open question. Now, I don't know if it's up to the Supreme Court, once again, to decide that question. And I do, my guess, if I had to make a hot take prediction, my guess is that they don't take the insurrection question on at all and figure out some kind of off-ramp. So, for instance, there's an open question as to whether the president is, quote unquote, an officer of the United States per the language of the Constitution. Now, you and I sitting here can say it's obvious the guy's it's the chief officer of the enterprise. Well, look at the language of the Constitution. It's not entirely clear how you define officers, and even there are provisions that refer to the president, comma, vice president, comma, and officers of the United States. So there's an implication that it's not, you know, this idea of is the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment self-executing? Do we need a specific law from Congress, which does not exist, that tells you how to actually operate it? And Supreme Court could say, well, it's not even self-executing. And until Congress passes a law with instructions on this, you can't have secretaries of state in Colorado or Maine or wherever else just deciding that the president is an insurrectionist. So I think they've got a veritable smorgasbord of options in which to decide how to make this go away without wagging a finger and saying, you, Donald Trump, are an insurrectionist. And I'd be stunned for their own reputation, preserving their own reputation, that they didn't try to do that.
Well, Elliot, I grew up in New York City, and I've been on the subway many times in my life.
Now, wait, let me ask you a question. Were you on the subway by any chance on December 22nd, 1984, on the downtown to IRT Express?
With Bernard Goetz? No.
Yes.
But you know something about that, don't you?
That's the rumor. I am quickly becoming one of the world's foremost experts on Bernard Goetz and his shooting on the New York City subway on December 22nd, 1987.
And you have a book coming out, don't you?
I do. I'm working right now on a book with Penguin Press about that case and its long legs into American sort of race, crime, and public safety in cities. Just looking at starting with the number of above the fold figures who got their starts on that case, Al Sharpton, Rudy Giuliani, Rupert Murdoch, the NRA, all of these folks have cameos in this story that I didn't even realize having grown up around there. I was in New Jersey about an hour away. And so it's a wild story when you unpack it that we still are feeling the effects of today.
Well, Elliot, we want to thank you for joining us today, and we hope the listeners found the discussion to be informative. If you have any questions or any feedback, please feel free to reach out to me, Jeff Jacobovitz. You can find my contact information on agg.com. And future podcast episodes will be distributed on our AGG website and social media pages. Thank you again for joining us, and thank you, Elliot.
That was wonderful. Thanks.